I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Listen, you mother...
Politics. Politics. Humor. Humor. Tequila. Tequila. And an IQ of under 64. Yeah. You're listening to Art Cop Radio, 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 Radio.
Hi, my name is Bart. Welcome to show 62 of Bart Cop Radio, seen on BartCop.com, heard on the Bart Cop Radio networks. Glad to have you here. Once again, we have no idea what we have today. Let me see if I can explain why. See, during the week, you know, you cut out little snippets from the newspaper or some, or maybe an article in Time magazine, something like that, and you try to organize your thoughts, and none of that seems to work. So when it comes time to do the show, basically most of my time is consumed with the page. And so I record little snippets here and then when I can, but basically I have to take a day from the radio to do a day's worth of speaking into the microphone, and then it generally takes a day's worth of post-production to get it in a suitable package to send to Tommy Mac, and then he does his voodoo on it, and it comes back. So I just really, it's always such a panic, you know, besides being hard work, everybody knows it's hard work. There's that high wire kind of insecurity, indecision kind of thing that, you know, the morning of the show, I got nothing. And somehow that day, the show goes from zero to whatever it ends up with, and that's hard work. What we think we have today, we got a little piece on Zell Miller, the prick. I don't like him. I don't mind saying it right up front. I don't like him at all, and I'm going to explain why. Got a little bit on the difference between Oprah and our good buddy Howard Stern. And even though you hate Stern, we got to stand behind some free speech, or there's no more Bart Cop, there's no more nothing, there's no more Sopranos, there's no more West Wing, there's no more television, there's no more radio, there's no more movies, there's no more nothing. So we got to keep one eye on free speech. Got a couple of letters to the editor. Those are always a lot of fun. Got something on the evils of the lottery. Do you really want to win $100 million? Then we have John McCain. Does everybody have the love-hate thing with John McCain? There's times when he gets on, he'll get on Leno or Letterman or something, and he'll just make sense, and he'll admit a bunch of things. He'll admit that Congress is corrupt and owned by special interests and stuff. You think, yeah, there's a guy I could almost vote for. And then he turns around and lets our boys down in Iraq. He just doesn't mind if they die, and that pisses me off. Got another story about the kids in Iraq that didn't come out the way I wanted it to. Also got a little ghost story for those of you who believe in ghosts and for those of you who don't believe in ghosts. When you see and hear things that you can't see and hear, you must attribute it to something. Maybe you can help me with that. And, of course, we got a little talk about poker on the front page of Tuesday's USA Today, the number one story, poker, and how it's destroying our nation. Oh, my God, can we do something to stop the evil poker madness that's consuming our children? So, that's what we think we got on today's show, plus whatever Tommy and Tally whipped together. Let me see, how do we get the show started? Oh, that's right. Little shot of Chinaco. You know something, maybe I shouldn't say this, but I have recently cheated a little bit on my Chinaco. When we went to Arkansas, I didn't bring any Chinaco. I bought a bottle of Don Eduardo. Oh, it's so good. If the Chinaco factory ever breaks up, I think I'm going right to Don Eduardo. Oh, God, it is so nice. It's just like Chinaco. It's just a little different. You know, they use a little different wildflowers, a little different kind of pears, a little different kind of apples. It's just, they're like brothers. But it is just so fine. Oh, God, I won't ever stop drinking tequila. It is just so nice. I just can't stand how you can get a kick out of a couple of sips of liquid, what, 1,000 times a month? That is just amazing that every time that liquid hits my tongue, I think, damn, that's nice. I mean, I don't know of anything else. You can't look at a picture 1,000 times a month or hear a sound 1,000 times a month and say, damn, that sounds good. But that taste, yep, that keeps on giving. Okay, Big, big show. Let's get into it.
This is www.bartcop.com.
Okay, now we got some good news and some bad news. I'll give you the bad news first, but don't hang up. Don't shut it off. The bad news is, this little bit is about Scott Peterson, but the good news is, it's probably the last one we'll ever do. He's been found guilty, he's been sentenced to death, and there's not a whole lot, I mean, there's not, even if they come up with some new evidence, even if someone comes forward now and confesses, it's my opinion that they can't undo this sentence. I think he's just stuck, and he's probably not going to be put to death. He's probably going to sit on death row the rest of his life. But, yeah, let's go ahead and bury Scott Peterson right here. Have you ever heard, you probably heard this 1,000 times, Randy Rhodes always talks about it. If you ask somebody, why did you vote for Bush? They can't give you a straight answer. They might stupidly say, oh, because I love what he's done with the economy and I love the way he's handled the war, but they don't really mean that. Those are things for them to say. If Bush had ever done anything right in his life, then someone could point to it and say, I like the way he did that, but he's never done anything right. He's always screwed up everything he's ever touched. That's how he does things. And on top of that, after he screws up, he declares himself a great success. The media and the Democrats and talk radio and the cable Nazis, everybody agrees that he's the greatest, smartest, bravest man that's ever been. And so he just claims, you know, even though he's lost the game 50-0, he claims victory and walks off the field, and everybody agrees that he's the master of the genre, and he knows what he's doing, and he's the greatest. If you get a little bit more honest appraisal of Bush, people will say, well, you know, I don't really know why I'm I like the guy. You know, maybe he didn't do so good here. And it's funny, sometimes you hear people say, you know, I don't like what he's done with the economy. I don't like what he's done in Iraq. I don't like the way he's so reckless and stupid and can't answer questions and can't win a debate and can't hold a press conference. But I kind of like the guy. You know, I just really can't put my finger on it. That's what I got out of this Scott Peterson mess. You probably saw it. I was sitting there working on the page, working real hard like a little beaver when they found him. Well, they found him guilty when I was in Little Rock at that wedding, at that funeral. But when they sentenced him to death, they had their jurors come out, and they said, so what was it? What one piece of evidence did it for you? And they said, well, there really wasn't one piece of evidence. It was just the whole thing, just the entirety of it. It all just seemed to point towards him, and we can't really explain it, but we're just pretty sure he did it. And that's very confusing. One lady kept saying, you know, a father is supposed to protect the family, not murder the family. You know, I understand what she must have been meaning to say, but you don't find a man guilty because that's not what a father is supposed to do. You're supposed to find a man guilty because his fingerprints were on the knife, because the witnesses saw him do it. He had her blood spattered on his shoe that he hid, and he thought nobody could find it. I mean, that's what we call evidence. But the best I could do for evidence was it just seemed like the type of guy. Something else we have to, and I don't know how much this has been on my mind through this whole Scott Peterson thing, but I wonder how much of this is anti-Clinton backlash. I mean, his lawyer is Mark Garagos. He's a Democrat lawyer. He helped the Clinton friends. So he's obviously got to be a homosexual, perverted, weirdo that's out to destroy justice in America. I mean, that's just pretty much a fact. And so I wonder how much of this was an anti-Clinton backlash, the idea that Scott Peterson had to be guilty, he had to be sacrificed, he must be put to death, because he's in there with at Garagos, he represents Michael Jackson, the baby raper. So that's what he does. That's Garagos. He represents the baby rapers and the mother killers and this Susan McDougal lady who lied to get her lover Bill Clinton off the hook. That's how a lot of people are looking at this. Now, they heard this idiot Joe DeGeneva, I think is his name. He was real big during impeachment. Maybe he was a judge at one time, but anyway, he's one of these idiot talking heads that everything is decided on. Is the man liberal or Democrat or Republican or conservative? Everything decides that. And I heard him say, I think I heard him say this, that Scott Peterson was so guilty that he went fishing in the area where they found her body. And that's not true. They found her body in the area where he claimed he went fishing. Now, that's all the difference in the world. Joe DeGenovic kept saying that Scott Peterson went fishing in the same place they found the body, and that isn't true, but he kept saying it, and as everybody knows, if you get on TV and say it enough times, it is absolutely true. Another thing I don't get, Mark Garagos committed the cardinal art sin of all time in that he wasn't present when they read the verdict. Now, I don't know how this works. My good friend Jeffrey Toobin was similarly totally outraged. He could not believe it. It's like it had never been done in the history of jurisprudence has a lawyer not been there for the verdict. And I'm thinking, California is kind of a big state. Peterson was tried in Redwood City or Red something, which I believe is in the northern part of the state, you know, like up there by Stockton or Sacramento, which is probably an hour or two even by jet. The way I remember it, this verdict came back about 3 hours after they gave the case to the jury. And that was, in my opinion, very unexpected. I think O.J.'s was about the same, but that's really, really rare. And this trial went off for weeks and weeks and months and months and months. Trust me, you put anybody in a bowl, a fish bowl, and say you're not going home until you come back with a verdict. Oh, well, we're not going to go all through the trial again, but it was just kind of unbelievable that for weeks and weeks and weeks, they played these recordings of Scott Peterson lying to Amber Fry to get into her pants to impress her with, oh, I'm a jet setter, now I'm in Paris. And they played those tapes again and again and again and again and just went on and on and on and on and on and on. That had nothing at all to do with the trial, but it just seemed like he was going to be found guilty. You know, we're just going through the motions here. We're going to find this bastard guilty, and we're going to put him to death, or at least sentence him to death. But meanwhile, we're going to play these tapes as if being a liar was proof of murder. But anyway, like I say, we can't go through the whole trial again. Jeffrey Toobin and this Joe DeGenova both agreed it was the worst thing a band could possibly do, not be there when they read the verdict. In my opinion, the verdict was a surprise. The timing of the verdict was a surprise. You know, if this trial was in Nebraska and Peterson was being tried in Omaha and Garagos was in, where's the football team play? Lincoln. And it's what, a 40-minute drive at maximum, and Garagos wasn't there for the reading. Now you may have something, but anyone that's ever been to L.A. knows you can be 2 hours on the freeway, and you're still in L.A. If someone rang Garagos at 9 o'clock in the morning and said they're going to read the verdict at 10:30, if you've been in L.A., you know there's no guarantee he can get to the airport by 10:30, much less get to the airport. And I don't think Garagos has a private jet. Does he have private jets sit around waiting? Mr. Garagos, would you like to go somewhere right now? If he finds out at 9 o'clock that a verdict is in at 10:30, what's he going to call Southwest and book a flight? And there, you know, but for some reason, my good friend Jeffrey Toobin and this idiot monster, Joe DeGenova, they made such a big deal out of Garagos not being there for the verdict. I don't understand it. Of course, you can't get any kind of honesty on TV. Jeffrey Toobin's there to fill a void, and I think he understood that America wanted this bastard gotten. They wanted him guilty. They wanted him hung. And so he kind of went along with the ride, a little like Nancy Grace. I'm a little disappointed in Jeffrey Toobin. Not that he wasn't a champion for Peterson's side, but everybody seemed to kind of forget about the law and the logic and the rules of science when it came to we just know he's guilty. The other thing, you know, it's going to be a happy Christmas in California this year because they found him guilty. When they said the words guilty, the cheers erupted. Oh, it was a circus. The place just went bonkers. Everybody loved it. Cops were smoking dope, dogs and cats having sex in the streets. It was just awful. It was just the biggest celebration you ever saw. Scott Peterson is guilty. Let it ring on high. Shout it from the mountaintops and play the trumpets and strike up the band. Scott Peterson is guilty. Oh, let's start dancing. Bunch of square dancing breaking out everywhere. And it was just the party of the century because they found this guy guilty of a terrible crime for which there was little or no evidence. I mean, just think how different the world would be if Scott Peterson told his dad that he bought the damn boat. And another thing, the misinformation that keeps coming around. I remember one funny thing Garagos said. They said, oh, and they caught Scott Peterson when he was trying to flee the country with his goatee and his brother's driver's license and $10,000, $15,000 in cash. And Gary Ghost pointed out that, you know, at the time they pulled his truck over, he was heading north. So he was in San Diego visiting his parents. Again, oh, he was heading for the border. Well, his parents lived in San Diego. Pardon him for wanting to see his parents. Anyway, Gary Ghost pointed out that if you're going to charge him with fleeing the country, you have to admit that the country he was heading towards was Canada. But that just kind of put in perspective how whatever information that you and I got out of this trial came through the lens of the media whores who had a hot, hot story on their hands and they wanted to sell it, and they made... Take away Clinton, Kerry, and Gore. Have you ever in your life, in your whole life, have you ever seen multiple networks go after a guy like they went after Scott Peterson? They didn't do it with OJ. They didn't do it, as far as I know, with any other person in history. Well, let's say in the modern age, in the TV age. But all the networks went after Scott Peterson, and they just couldn't contain their glee. And, of course, you know, the worst was Nancy Grace and those gaggle of four women over at CNN. Well, Nancy Grace was on every network. So was Gloria Allred. But they just couldn't believe how much fun this hanging was going to be. They just sat there and giggled again and again. We got a dead woman here with a 1,000-watt smile. But they just kept giggling and giggling and giggling about getting Scott Peterson. And I just thought it was a little on the distasteful side. Another sidebar on the, think how big it was in this trial that the fetus had a name. And how do we know that the fetus had the name? It's possible that Scott and Lacey picked out this name, but really nobody, this wasn't a national case until after she was missing and or dead. So any facts, unquote, that we got about this case came from distraught family members and people in a panic and people not themselves. But think, had the fetus not been named, what if she was just pregnant Lacey? But no, it was always Lacey and baby Connor. Oh, poor helpless baby Connor. I mean, him having that name generated just another mountain of emotion that, oh, not only did he kill his wife, who may have been nagging at him and yakety-yakety, oh, but he killed baby Connor. It's just so awful. Just that one point, that the fetus had a name, that could have been the spike through Peterson's heart right there. If they hadn't named the baby, as far as we know, they didn't. As far as we know, that's, you know, 10 years ago, Lacey thought Connor was a fun name. She might name her baby that. And they thought, well, she was pregnant when she died. I'll bet she was going to name poor little baby Connor. And I'm not making fun of Lacey or the baby or the crazy family. But if the fetus hadn't had a name, that might have swung things. And isn't that awful? Jurors who spoke publicly for the first time since the trial started in June, and this is December, that no single piece of evidence convinced them of Peterson's guilt. There are so many things, said juror Rochelle Nice, an unemployed mother of four. Scott Peterson was Lacey's husband, Connor's daddy, the one person that should have protected them, and for him to have done that. Well, they asked her what the evidence was, and they said he was the father. That's the evidence that on which she judged this guy guilty and let's murder him because he was the father. That's the evidence. Jurors said they were influenced by a key prosecution argument that Peterson killed his wife so he could enjoy a bachelor lifestyle. And that's why he hooked up with a woman with a kid? While they were looking for his wife and son, he was romancing his girlfriend, said jury foreman Steve whatever. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense at all. Well, do you murder a guy because you don't understand what he's going through? And if Scott Peterson is the criminal of the century, the guy who committed the perfect crime, who, name another time when you've got no murder weapon, no scene of the crime, no forensics, no anything. Somehow Scott Peterson was able to pull that off, and he didn't have the brains to act interested in his missing wife. See, that doesn't make a lot of sense, but I'm not ready to kill the guy because I can't explain his motives. But yeah, that was really stupid of him. And I wonder if every man in the middle of this who gave it a 5 second thought wondered how they would react to their missing wife who then was later found dead. I mean, who knows how you would act? I doubt if it happened to me, I doubt I'd be out selling Mrs. Bart's touring sedan or whatever some of the goofy things Scott did. But it just seemed like a really no evidence way to hang the guy. Here's another one. Peterson's fishing alibi struck jurors as too much coincidence to believe. And again, what do we know about this? He dumped her in the San Francisco Bay, and in the San Francisco Bay, a few thousand miles of shoreline. And, you know, they said she showed up. she surfaced a mile or two from where he said he was. Well, I don't know. Is that close? Is that coincidental? I don't know anything about the area. I mean, if there's a watering hole, you know, if there's a pond that's 100 feet wide and he went fishing there and the body showed up, now that makes some sense. But if this is San Francisco Bay we're talking about, if it's the biggest body of water that's the closest for maybe 30 million people, I'll bet between Northern California and Mid-California, and say go 100 miles inland, which you have to do to get to the town where Scott and Lacey are from, there's got to be 30 million people in that area. And for 30 million people to have access to the San Francisco Bay and the bodies show up there and they decide, well, that's where Scott was. Well, geez, I don't know. That's where 30 other million people could have been. But, of course, that's just nitpicking because I like murders. This guy said, too much coincidence to believe. If those bodies had been found in the desert or Yosemite, we wouldn't be here today. But those bodies were found in the one place where Peterson had been. Peterson had been in one place, and that was this little creek part of San Francisco Bay. I played in my mind over and over conspiracies. Was somebody trying to set up Scott? Was somebody after Lacey? It didn't add up for me. Some legal analysis said that even though Peterson didn't fit the profile of defendants typically sentenced to death in California, it seemed clear he had earned the jury's enmity. They looked at that man and they saw a monster, said Lori Levinson, law professor at Loyola. A monster in a handsome face, a monster from a good family, but a monster nonetheless. Well, you know, he's also a monster without a record, if I remember correctly. Here's a guy without a record. Apparently, like, remember O.J. slapped Nicole around and pushed, they said he pushed her out of a moving car once. Well, you know, yeah, really. Think about it. Did he really push her? But anyway, I'm just saying, stories come in from the family. O.J. was always apparently slapping around Nicole. Remember they called the police the famous time they showed up in it? But there was never any testimony. Scott ever laid it, never even raised his voice to Lacey. But he's a monster. He's a handsome monster who was failing to protect his baby. Yep, so this is, I guess, our last Scott Peterson story. Not that I'm sad to see it go, but, boy, I would just hate, even for the stalkers, even for the crazy diddle monkeys, doesn't everyone hate the idea that innocent man might spend the rest of his life in solitary confinement on death row because people looked at him and saw a monster and they just couldn't figure out another way? And if he lied to get in some girl's pants, well, that is evidence of murder. That and he bought the stupid boat, didn't tell his dad, it all adds up to murder. And he went fishing, he said, but he had the wrong kind of bait? Well, if that's not proof of murder, I don't know what is, but... Okay, Scott, our last mention of you, probably, maybe. Okay, one other point about Garagos. They said at the beginning of the trial in his opening statement that he would prove beyond a doubt that Scott Peterson was stone cold innocent. Now, I didn't hear him say that, and we can only trust the lying, money-making whores that he did say it. But assuming he did for a second, why would he say that and then fail to deliver? Surely any guy in his first trial would know, don't promise something that you can't deliver, and especially don't do it in such a dramatic way if that's how he did it. Again, we get this information from lying, scheming TV whores whose job it is not to tell the facts or to make us, not to give us the real story, but is to embellish the story and make it so good that we won't turn that dial. That's the rule here. That's what they're trying to do. The truth and the facts come last. The drama and the intensity of the argument, that's got to be the big thing, the hook that gets you coming back. So why would Garagos promise that? Did something change? Did he have facts at the beginning of the trial that changed or were discredited or whatever during the trial? When to stand up there and say, I will prove he is stone cold innocent, and then not to put him on the stand or not offer anything besides impeaching the state's, in my opinion, worthless witnesses, why would a fella do that? Anyone have any clues out there? What kind of evidence could Garagos have had that changed? I mean, if he had three neighbors that saw Mark in a different part of town all morning, and then he said, I'm going to prove to you he's stone cold innocent, and then during the trial he finds out those people were, whatever, hospitalized for hallucinations. Well, yeah, that kind of thing. But somehow he made a promise that he couldn't back up, and this monkey de Genova decided to jump all over him for that. Sadly, I don't guess your ghost can ever talk about it. No one can ever, if they ask him how that work, what happened, he cannot answer that if I understand the laws correctly. He can't get up there even if Scott Peterson is murdered in prison next week. Your ghost can't explain his trial strategy ever. All we can ever get out of this is other attorneys guessing, and that really tells us nothing. But wouldn't it be interesting to know, why did Gary Ghost promise that which he could not deliver? One last thought about this Gary Ghost thing. I think the reason everybody was pissed, unreasonably, in my opinion, they were unreasonably enraged at Gary Ghost for not being there when they read the sentence, because they wanted to zero in on his face. They wanted to look him in the eye and say, neener, neener, Mr. Big Shot Lawyer, your guy lost. What do you say about that? They missed out on their soundbite, and that's what pissed them off. They wanted him to be there so they could point and make fun, and Nancy Grace could giggle. See, I told you he was guilty. See, I told you he was guilty. Giggle, giggle, giggle. They missed out on all that because Gary Ghost wasn't there that day. And how dare he do that? He robbed him of that, and for that he had to pay. So let's all get on TV and rake them in over the coals obsessively because he wasn't there. He wasn't unable to be in the other part of California. It's a big state. It's a big ass state. I'll bet it's 500 miles if it's an inch from the northern to southern California. And he wasn't there within an hour and a half on command, on demand, be here. And he couldn't be there then. So that's proof of his guilt too. They're all guilty. They're all Clintonites. Let's hang them. One story in the USA Today, Tuesday the 21st, big giant picture right in the center, right underneath the USA Today logo, poker at an early age, not just another teen fad, with some parents even supporting kids' poker parties. Addiction experts wonder whether stakes are too high. Oh my God, the kids are playing poker. We'd rather have them in the streets having sex, shooting heroin, and at home playing a card game. My God. Oh, it's so awful. They just attack them on every front you can imagine. And as you know, we can't allow that. So we're going to take a couple of the quotes from this and refute them. First of all, you just got to know, they're not worried about the children. If we're looking at what's hurting our children, how about their death in Iraq? How about their lack of funding because they're going to have no Social Security when they get older? How about the fact that mom and dad don't have a job because Bush gave away billions to the super rich like Bill Gates and Oprah? Poker's not a problem. The first thing a kid's going to learn about poker is he's going to learn about life. He's going to learn about what works and what doesn't work. He's going to learn about odds. He's going to learn about values. I don't know what a kid gets today for an allowance, if the kids even get an allowance. When I was a kid, oh, Christ, that was when a nickel would buy you a new car. So, yeah, we'd get a nickel a week or something. But kids today, what do you give a kid today? Maybe 20 bucks? Say you give a kid 20 bucks. I don't even know if that'll work. I mean, Christ, you can't go to a movie. If you go to a movie and buy a Coke and a hot dog, you're out 20 bucks. So I don't know if a kid can survive on 20 bucks a week. And by a kid, let's talk about, let's say just the kids in this article are less than driving age, say from 12 to 15. They got to have 50 bucks a week to just get by, don't they? But anyway, let's say you give a kid 50 bucks Friday night. And Friday night, he goes to a poker game and he loses his $50. Now, Saturday, he can't do nothing. Sunday, he can't do nothing. All during the week, he can't do nothing. He is dead effing broke until next Friday because he stupidly bet on a pair of nines in a poker game. So he learned right away that if you bet on a pair of nines in a poker game, you're liable to lose. You're going to have no money all week. So next time you don't do that. He has learned something. He's learned the value of a pair of nines. There's not much in a pair of nines. So he's learned that. Next time he gets a pair of aces, yes, he goes all in. Now he wins the other kid's money. Now he's got 60 bucks or 100 bucks something in his pocket. Now he understands that you bet on a winner and you don't bet on a loser. Think how that'll help him in an election booth, for example. But every decision the kid's going to make the rest of his life, he's going to have to weigh the odds. He's going to have to weigh the risks against the rewards. He's going to have to ask himself how many other people are in the game. He's going to have to, you know, they have these things called outs. You know, if the only way you can win is if a four comes up and there's two fours on the table, that means you've got two chances to win, two out of, call it 50, so you got a 4% chance of winning. If you bet a whole lot of money on a 4% chance, you're going to lose one out of every 25 times. That's pretty easy to figure out. And now and then, the one out of 25 comes through, but as a rule, it doesn't. That's just the same way it is in real life. Now and then, lightning hits the same guy twice, or the one in a billion comes through, or something, you know, you run into your old girlfriend at the mall you haven't seen in 30 years. I mean, yeah, now and then the crazy one in a million comes through, but as a rule, it doesn't happen that way. So why not teach the little sons of, why not teach the little kids up front that this is the way life works? Sometimes you sometimes the idiot wins, sometimes you do everything right and you lose. These are life's lessons that these kids are learning. And what is the bad news? Oh, the bad news is the addiction to poker. Well, hey, guess what, Sparky? You can't be physically addicted to poker. You might get addicted to poker in the sense that it's fun. You'd rather play poker than bowl. You'd rather play poker than watch basketball on TV. You'd rather play poker than play chutes and ladders with your little sister. You'd rather play poker than mow the lawn. You know, a lot of people would rather play poker than do other things. Some people would rather play poker than have sex. Some people would rather play poker than do drugs and alcohol. Some people would rather play poker than commit crimes. Now see, poker doesn't look so bad all of a sudden. So what do they have against it? Gambling experts warn that poker mad. Well, see, now the kids are mad. Poker madness. See, the kids have turned mad. The kids are insane because they played a game of poker. My God, why is it in USA Today's best interest to fabricate a witch hunt? Let's pick out something that's effing harmless and we'll make it into the next great threat that's going to take your kids away from you. Never mind Bush and what he's doing. Never mind the missing $11 trillion. Never mind the $2 billion a day that they're throwing away, giving to China so Bush can get a foothold there. Never mind the lack of the Constitution. Never mind the throwing your vote away. Never mind the 1,300 dead in Iraq. We got to worry about poker. Poker's the demon. It drives our kids mad. Okay, poker mad teens are sailing a small sailboat into a menacing typhoon. Oh, the menacing typhoon. They could lead to a gambling addiction as well as other risky activities such as drug abuse. Fuck you. Drug abuse. Yeah, if they're shooting heroin at the poker game, yeah, you might get turned on some heroin. But what if they're not? What if they're playing poker? Told the people a long, long time ago, number one rule in poker is deal the cards. You don't want to talk about football. You don't want to talk about real estate. You don't want to talk about the Mets. You don't want to talk about nothing. You deal the cards. You know, if somebody pulls out a bunch of drugs, hey, after the game. Right now we're playing cards. You know what I mean? You play the cards. That's what these kids are learning, that distractions will make you lose in your poker game. So you don't want distractions. Drug abuse. Oh, addiction, please. What the hell's wrong with people? Kids are gambling with their health when they play poker, because for some people, this can get very serious, says Keith White, executive director of the nonprofit National Council on Problem Gambling. Well, who the hell's got a gambling problem because they like to play poker? Isn't the definition of a gambling problem someone who wants to lose? Isn't that how that works, that the junkie who's betting on the football game, and he knows his team can't win, but he bets anyway for the thrill of, I don't know what the thrill is, because I've never been addicted to gambling. I just really like the game of poker, and a bunch of other people do too. So we got to stamp it out, because it's unhealthy, because it'll kill you, and get you addicted to drugs. You don't want your kids in your house playing cards on a weekend night. No, you want them out on the street, running with gangs. Yeah, there you go. Council studies show that among kids who gamble 50%, it's a good thing this guy isn't here. You know, sometimes you just F the debate and you just strangle the guy. Council study shows that among kids who gamble, 50% are likely to binge drink and 75% are likely to smoke pot. Well, now, asshole, I got a question for you. What if you grab 100 kids off the street and ask them which were breastfed? I'll bet you that 50% of the kids who are breastfed will end up binge drinking, and I'll bet 75% of the kids who are breastfed are likely to smoke pot. So we must stop breastfeeding. We've got to stop it. We got to nip it in the bud right now. No more breastfeeding. Because if you breastfeed, you're 50% likely to binge drink and 75% likely to smoke pot. So all breastfeeding is hereby outlawed. Idiots! What's wrong with these people? If parents really understood the consequences, they'd be less likely to let them engage in this type of activity. Oh, we might as well be sharing dirty needles. We might as well be throwing knives at each other. I know, how about we climb a construction site and see who can balance on the 15th floor? Cool! We'll get on some girder on the 15th floor, drunk, and we'll throw darts at each other. There you go. That's a lot safer than gambling. Gambling, please. State and local governments aren't looking into this consistently. Some are trying, though. Come January, students in Orlando area high schools will get anti-gambling messages slipped into their core curriculum, says Pat Fowler, executive director of the Florida Council on Compulsive Gambling. The point is to at least let the kids know, whether it's in health class or math class, that the risks of gambling are real. That's what I've been saying. Teach these kids what's real. Teach them what risks are acceptable and which risks are not. Driving drunk is so totally unacceptable. It is 100% pure risk idiocy. That's what you need to teach these kids. The odds, when you get in a car drunk, the odds of you dying zoom way the hell up. Now, see, you teach the kid about odds. That four I was saying you need a while ago, there's only two of them in the deck. You got a 1 in 25 chance. Well, you're not 24 out of 25 to die if you get in a car drunk. But the idea that you explain to the kids, maybe you'd rather walk in the dark a mile. Say you're a mile from home and your ride is drunk. So you tell yourself, getting in the car with a drunk is risky. Walking home by myself in the dark is risky. I'm forced to take a risk. Let's say you got no cell phone, et cetera, et cetera. You're forced to take a risk. So a gambler will know which risk is a better risk to take. Do you want to drive with the guy drunk? Do you want to walk in the dark? Both have risks. If you teach poker, you're going to learn about risk. I don't know why they're so anti-education. We're trying to teach the little bugger something so they can grow up and be successful. In Connecticut, State Senator-elect Andrea Stillman has been pushing for a new law requiring schools to teach students about gambling risks. I sense parents don't realize how this can be addictive, she says. Oh, so addictive. Yeah, it's a damn lot of fun. People that learn how to play poker, they really like the game of poker, and they like to play it a bunch, too. Oh, so it's got to be dangerous. What poker offer? Oh, here we go. How about hearing the sane side of it? By contrast, one college recently allowed new students to put their poker talents on display. In September, the University of California at Los Angeles set up a poker tournament for a donated door prize as part of its freshman orientation. Out of 400 attendees, 80 played poker. Barry Shulman understands the game's siren call. It's so fun it can consume you, he says. He publishes Card Player magazine, so he's a poker dude. I get emails from kids all the time. I'm impressed how focused they are, how much they ask about the statistical aspects of the game. See, the kids are learning math. The little sons of guns are learning math. You drag a kid into algebra class and you try to explain statistics or geometry or whatever to them, and they just don't care. But if you explain to them, you're at the final table at the World Series of Poker, and you got to have a four, a black queen, or a seven. One of those three will win you the pot. Now, what are your odds? You put that kind of example on an algebra or geometry kind of question, and the kids will sit there and figure because it's fun. They're going to learn something. You tell them, you know, Betty's got three apples. They don't care about Betty and her damn apples. But you tell them they're going to win a poker tournament if they figure out the odds. Suddenly you got kids, 10 and 12-year-old kids, huddling and working out math problems to figure out the statistical probability. Another thing I mentioned is before about the pot odds. If there's $500 in the pot and it costs you $20 to call, even if you've got nothing, you put that money in because you're going to bet 20 with a chance of winning 520. Even if you got nothing, you bet when the odds are with you like that. On the other hand, if there's $50 in the pot and a guy raises you 500, well, it don't matter if you got a pair of aces. You've got a 10 out of 11 disadvantage before you even look at it. So you say no, even if you got a good hand. This is what you teach the kids. It's called learning. It's called education. All right, closing up here. Shulman says poker offers teens five things. Social interaction, that's a good thing. I wasn't particularly awkward or general personality as a kid. I was just kind of in the middle, kind of a regular guy. But you can see how being at a, it's an icebreaker. You sit down If you just throw a party, you know, the guys stand on one side of the room, girls stand on the other side of the room, and, you know, a couple hours go by and they start talking, kind of thing. Hey, you set them down at a poker table and suddenly you got conversation, you got things going on. So, yeah, helps with that social interaction. Help with math and other numbers-related skills. Damn lots of help with math. I've always been good at math. Not that I'm good at poker, but I can figure it out real quick. Sometimes I disregard the odds because I'm having fun, because it's a lot of fun to play poker. Sometimes when you got to have a four to win, you go ahead and call, because if that four hits, that's a big party. That's part of playing the game. You can play like super serious and play, you know, 80 hands and get involved in two of them, or you can play the game a little bit, relax, loosen up. Especially that last time we went to Vegas, $1 and $2 blinds. If you don't have $3 to your name, don't go near poker. And it's not like it's for the rich. $3 every 10 hands. That's 30 cents a hand. If you don't have 30 cents, yes, poker is not for you. Poker is only for people that have 30 cents or more. When you're sitting at the world famous World Series of Poker, the home of the World Series, for 30 cents a hand. Name another sport. You can't go to Yankee Stadium for 30 cents. You can't go to Lambeau Field in Green Bay for 30 cents. You can't go to Lambeau Field in Green Bay and play on the field for 30 cents. No. But if you're in Vegas, you can sit at the table where they play the World Series for 30 cents and have a real damn good time. Now, see? Is that awful? Okay, more good news. An understanding of risk-reward scenarios. Yes, I said it first. Lessons on how to read looks and gestures. You're going to think I'm nuts, but that has really helped me. I've done some business with some people in the last 60 days, and I've been able to read them much better, just because after a while, it's not like you sit there and study the guy's face, but the time it takes to answer, how he chose to answer, the words he used, the risks he took. If you ask someone, explain this to me, did they give you a cautious answer? Why did they give you a cautious? Why not a bold answer? You get a whole lot of that when you play poker. Lastly, insights into your own limits of self-control. Well, we won't go there. People that don't like poker, you know, just blow me. Can we not have one thing that you're not going to attack? You know, Jesus, it's weird. If the sun comes out, we got to attack. Well, we've already attacked the sun. It'll kill you, skin cancer. But it's just like there's nothing in this world that you just can't have to yourself. You know, the internet's bad. Cars are bad. Food is bad. Red meat's bad. Alcohol's bad. Breathing the air is bad. Every fucking thing in the world has got life-killing problems. And you just can't turn anywhere without someone, some asshole, attacking something that you like to do. Anything in the world that you want to do. It's just horrible to someone else, and they got to get on the front page of the USA Today and scream about how horrible the decision you've made are. Poker's a nice, fun game. Sure, if the kids get online, if they start hocking their stereos, now you got a problem. What, out of 100 kids, how many of them are going to lose their stereos? How many are going to lose their $100 tennis shoes? I'll tell you what, kid works real hard mowing lawns to come up with a $100 pair of tennis shoes, and then he loses them in a poker game. He's got to mow, whatever, another 10 or something lawns. I don't know what lawn mowers get these days, but you learn that way. Like when I was a little kid. Bart, did you put your bike away? No. Well, you don't want your bike, do you? You want the next kid walking by to steal your bike, don't you? No. Well, then you better get your butt outside and put your bike in the basement. Okay. So you learn right away. If you don't protect it, you got to protect what you have. If you lose what you have, you learn next time. Might as well have a 12-year-old learn the value of a pair of shoes then, rather than have him discover poker when he's 25 and then he loses his car and his house. No, let him learn the lesson when he's little. Get it out of the way when you're a kid. Learn the lessons early so you can have the lessons all your life. That makes a lot of sense. They just got to come after poker. They must have read that I liked it. That's why they decided to attack it.
You got to know when to hold up. Know when to fold up. Know when to walk away. Know when to run. You never count your money. When you're sitting at the table, there'll be time enough for counting when the deal's done.
This is not a pansy liberal show. It's